Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're trying something challenging. We're attempting to map out one of the most complex fields in medicine, psychiatry. It's often misunderstood, isn't it?
It really is, and it's unique. Think about it. Most doctors treat, you know, a specific organ you can point to, a lung, a heart.
Right.
But psychiatry, it deals with conditions affecting our consciousness, our identity, our thoughts, our emotions, things you can't exactly put on a slide.
That's the core problem, isn't it? The big question we want to explore. How does medicine even begin to treat the mind who we are when all it can physically see, all it can measure is the brain?
It feels almost like translating between two different languages.
Exactly. A constant translation task.
It demands this incredible balancing act. And that's really our mission today. We're leaning on the work of Professor Tom Burns to try and find a nuanced answer to what is psychiatry, really? Especially now in the 21st century.
Okay.
It's a field that, by necessity, sits right at the crossroads of biology, psychology, and the messy reality of our social lives.
So let's talk about our guide here.
Yeah.
Our source is Tom Burns, Professor Emeritus of Social Psychiatry at Oxford. That focused social psychiatry. Why is that particularly important for this discussion?
Oh, it's crucial. It grounds everything in the patient's actual life, not just what happens in a lab or a clinic.
Right.
Burns' whole focus looks at those external forces, things like poverty, whether you have a job, community support, even stigma. How do these social factors impact mental illness and, just as importantly, recovery?
So his perspective stops us from falling into those simple traps, like thinking it's all just brain chemicals.
Or that it's all just about your childhood.
Right. He forces us to see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
From the synapse, you could say, right up to the local council's housing policy.
Precisely. His background really embodies the kind of integration psychiatry needs. And this takes us straight back to that fundamental challenge you mentioned earlier, the mind-brain problem. It just doesn't go away.
The subjective versus the objective. My feeling of, say, deep sadness is generated by a physical organ, the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But that feeling itself, mm-hmm. You can't dissect it. You can't weigh it.
That's it. The brain's the hardware, maybe, and the mind is the lived subjective experience of the person using it. Burns really highlights that psychiatry's unique job is to bridge that gap by integrating the latest biological findings with, and this is key, the patient's own story, their suffering, the meaning they make of their illness. It has to hold both.
Okay, so let's unpack the framework he uses for that integration.
Yeah.
Because Burns really pushes back against simplistic single-cause thinking that seems central. The biopsychosocial model, is this the main takeaway?
I'd say it's the conceptual spine of his analysis, definitely. Burns argues, quite forcefully, that to really understand and treat mental illness effectively, you absolutely have to look through all three lenses: biology, psychology, and social context.
Yeah.
None alone is enough.
Right. Let's break that down. What falls under the bio lens, the biological part?
Okay, so bio is the stuff medicine is traditionally comfortable with. Genetics, for example. We know some conditions, like schizophrenia, have a strong genetic component of predisposition.
But not destiny.
Absolutely not destiny. That's critical. It also includes neurochemistry, neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, and any physical structural issues in the brain itself.
Okay, but that's just one piece. Then we move to psycho, the psychological dimension.
Exactly. Psycho covers things like your individual temperament, your natural coping skills, or maybe unhelpful cognitive biases, those negative thought loops in depression, for instance.
Mm.
And crucially, it also includes life experiences. Trauma, abuse, neglect, things that really shape your psychological makeup, your inner world.
And then the third lens, the one Burns really champions, social. Yes. This is the wider environment. It includes immediate things like your family situation or feeling isolated, but also those bigger forces, your socioeconomic status, poverty, access to decent housing, cultural pressures.
Wow.
These create the stage, really, upon which someone either struggles or finds the resources to cope.
You can immediately see how powerful that interaction is. Let's take something common, like depression.
Mm-hmm.
How does this model show why it's almost never just one thing?
Great example. Okay, so someone might have a genetic vulnerability that's the bio part, making them perhaps more sensitive to stress.
Right.
Then they might lose their job or experience a major loss. That's the psycho element, a significant life event hitting their psychology hard.
Okay.
And at the same time, maybe they're living in poor housing, they feel isolated, no real support network, that's the social context.
Mm.
See how they all feed into each other?
Yeah, it becomes a downward spiral. Exactly. Burns shows that if you only treat the bio, maybe just prescribe an antidepressant, you're missing two huge parts of the puzzle. You're ignoring the context and the personal experience.
That makes so much sense. It's about the whole system.
Yeah.
But systems change. How did psychiatry get to this more integrated, if complex, approach? Maybe a quick look back. We have to acknowledge the history, right? The asylums.
We do. The origins were often grim, institutions that started with good intentions but often became places of neglect or worse. The first big shift in thinking, though, was the moral treatment movement, late 18th century.
Who was involved there?
Figures like Philippe Pinel in France, he basically argued for treating people with kindness, dignity, giving them purpose, instead of just chaining them up. A revolutionary idea back
A
then.
huge step. Then the 20th century brought massive changes, pulling in different directions, didn't it? Science versus meaning.
Sort of, yeah. On one hand, you had Emil Kraepelin really pushing for classification, trying to define disorders, observe their course, make it more systematic, scientific. That laid the groundwork for things like the DSM today.
Okay, for the scientific track.
But then you had Sigmund Freud, who came along with this totally different radical idea that symptoms weren't just random, they had meaning, they pointed to inner conflicts, the unconscious, and you could explore that through talking.
Talk therapy, a completely different approach.
Completely. And then after World War II, another game changer, the discovery of effective psychotropic drugs, things like chlorpromazine.
The first antipsychotics.
Exactly. And that discovery, that bio tool, was a major factor enabling the huge policy shift called deinstitutionalization,
Moving people out of the big institutions.
which was, in principle, a massive human rights advance, moving
Wow.
care into the community. But Burns gives us the crucial balanced perspective here. It was, well, an unfinished revolution. The intentions were good, but the funding for community services often just wasn't there. It led to massive problems, homelessness, people cycling in and out of hospitals, ending up in the justice system, the infamous revolving door.
So the bio part got a boost with medication, but the social support system needed for community care wasn't built properly.
That's a fair summary, yeah. The infrastructure often lagged way behind the policy.
Okay, let's shift to today's practice.
Yeah.
The tools psychiatrists use now, we have to talk about diagnosis first.
Yeah.
And those manuals, the DSM, the ICD, they get a lot of criticism, sometimes sounding like just checklists for human suffering.
They do face that criticism, and Burns tackles it directly. His view is that these manuals are essentially pragmatic but imperfect tools. They're necessary evils almost.
Medi-Cal.
They provide a common language, so a clinician in London and one in Tokyo can understand roughly what the other means by schizophrenia. It's vital for research, for communication, for structuring treatment trials, but crucially, they are descriptive systems, meaning they describe clusters of symptoms that tend to occur together. They're not discovering fundamental biological truths, like finding a new type of cell. They're constructs. Useful ones, hopefully, but still constructs.
The distinction feels really important. They're useful for communication, but they aren't the final word on who someone is, because the risk is labeling, stigma.
Absolutely. The risk of reducing a person to a label is always there. Burns stresses they're necessary for the field to function scientifically, but clinicians have to use them wisely, understanding their limitations.
Okay, now what about treatment itself? The modern toolkit seems split, right? Between the pharmacological and the psychological.
Broadly, yes. On the pharmacological side, the bio side, you have your antidepressants, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, and so on. Burns notes they can be very effective for many people.
But not magic bullets.
Definitely not magic bullets. And often we still don't fully understand exactly how they work on the incredibly complex network of the brain. They help manage symptoms, often significantly, but they rarely cure in the way an antibiotic cures an infection.
And then the talking therapies, the psychodimension.
Right. And there's a huge range there. You can contrast something like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which is often quite structured, present focus, looking at changing thought patterns and behaviors, with more psychodynamic approaches, which might delve deeper into past experiences, unconscious patterns, the therapeutic relationship itself.
It's better.
Often it's not another. Burns points out, and the evidence generally supports this, that the combination medication to stabilize symptoms, plus therapy to address underlying issues and build coping skills, often gives the best, most lasting results. The biopsychosocial approach in action.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, we have to touch on probably the most ethically complex area, something really unique to psychiatry. involuntary commitment, making someone accept treatment when they don't want it, that's a huge power.
It's immense. It's the sharpest point of tension in the whole field where medicine meets law, ethics, and individual liberty head on.
How is it justified?
Burns explains it's not something done lightly at all. The criteria are usually very strict. Generally, two things have to be true. First, the person must pose an immediate serious risk to their own life or safety, or to others.
Okay, risk assessment.
And second, crucially, their illness must be so severe that it impairs their capacity.
Capacity, meaning their ability to make decisions.
Exactly. Their ability to understand information about their condition and treatment, weigh the pros and cons, and make a reasoned decision for themselves. If someone is, say, acutely psychotic and unable to grasp reality, their capacity to refuse life-saving treatment might be deemed impaired.
That assessment must be incredibly difficult.
It's a profound responsibility. Burns emphasizes this isn't about psychiatrists wanting power. It's a legal and ethical duty society places on them in these extreme circumstances. It really underscores the gravity of the work.
So we've covered the model, the history, the tools, the ethics. Let's bring it back to the listener. What does all this mean for us in our everyday lives? How can understanding Burns' perspective help?
I think the most immediate application is in reducing stigma. If you see mental illness through that biopsychosocial lens, bio, psycho, and social feeling, it just dismantles the old harmful idea that it's purely a matter of willpower or moral failing.
Right. It's not someone's fault.
Exactly. It legitimizes the suffering as a complex issue stemming from interacting pressures, not just, you know, bad choices. It fosters empathy.
And what else?
It promotes informed advocacy. If you or someone you care about needs help, knowing that good treatment should ideally be holistic, looking at meds, therapy and social support empowers you.
How so?
You can ask better questions. You can push for more comprehensive care than maybe just a quick prescription. You understand the different pieces that should be considered.
So it helps you navigate the system.
Yes. And third, it raises policy awareness. Understanding the challenges, like the failures of underfunded deinstitutionalization, highlights why things like investing in community mental health services, supportive housing, tackling poverty, why these aren't just nice extras. They are fundamental to effective mental health care.
That social piece again. Burns really seems to hammer that home. He acknowledges the promise of future science, right? Genetics, neuroscience.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. He sees the potential for huge advances in the biosphere. But his concluding message is powerful. He argues that the future success, the soul of psychiatry, depends on holding that tension.
Tension between what?
Between the hard science and the deep humanism, between understanding the brain and understanding the person. No matter how sophisticated the neuroscience gets, the ultimate job, he says, will always be to relieve the suffering of a whole person living in a complex social world.
The whole person. That feels like the key phrase. It's a field demanding, it sounds like, the rigor of a scientist, the practical skills of a social worker, and the empathy of, oh, a fellow human being.
That blend is exactly it, which is why understanding this nuanced perspective from Burns feels so important.
It really does.
And maybe that leads to a final thought for you, the listener, to consider, something to chew on. Think about how much society's willingness or unwillingness to really tackle that social part of the model, things like poverty, isolation, housing insecurity, how much that will ultimately shape whether psychiatric treatments actually succeed or fail for the next generation. It might be the biggest factor of all.
A challenging thought indeed. Thank you. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.